The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I was lucky enough back in November to travel to one of the most beautiful wine regions in the world in Stellenbosch, South Africa. And if you want to go to a place that's as beautiful, maybe even more, the Moselle here in Germany, it is stunning. And thank you to the people of Wines of Germany for helping us set up some interviews. I am at the iconic Dr. Pauli Burgweiler. I'm sure I'll mispronounce it, in the town of Bernkastel. And I'm joined by the owner and winemaker, Stefan Pauli. Stefan, thank you so much for doing this.
Yes, welcome here in our Vinotheque where we're sitting. And we're going to taste some of our Rieslings here from the Dr. Pauli Burgweiler Wine Estate.
I got to tell everyone right now listening, I'm here with my girlfriend, her twin sister, and our friend Lindsay, and all of our eyes bugged out when we saw some of the old wines you're going to pour. And you know what? Let's just start here. Let's start in this direction. You have wines that are over 40 years old in front of us. What is it about Riesling? Like, tell people that are just getting into this wine, what is it about Riesling that makes it so age-worthy?
Okay, first of all, we have the advantage here at the wine estate that we date back really long time. So we were founded 1556, so a long, long time ago. Yeah. So we have some really old vintage Rieslings still in our private wine cellar. The reason why Riesling ages so well is because of the acidity. Back in the days, meaning like 40, 50, 60 years ago, they were bottling the Rieslings with much higher acidity than today. Mm-hmm. They didn't really do dry or half-dry wines. They just did the classical Cabinet, Spätlese, and Auslese, let them ferment for 6 months, let them sit for another 6 months, and then bottle them with a rather high acidity. So today, we might range between 7, 8, 9. Back then, it was maybe 11, 12, 13.
Right.
And that, of course, gives the advantage of aging potential.
Well, what's the first one? Because I want to get into you, Stefan, and your own journey into wine. But what is the first wine that you've poured for us today?
Yes, we will taste the old vintage Rieslings later. Mm-hmm. We will start here with our, you know, standard Riesling, the Riesling Trocken, how we say, the dry Riesling. Mm-hmm. So that's our standard Riesling. I have to say, this is a wine which we didn't sell so much back 30 years ago. So there has been a change. When I took over the wine estate in 2006, we were still selling quite a few cases of fruity wines. Today, we sell much, much more dry Rieslings worldwide. And as a wine estate, we really focus on export. So I would say like 80% of our production goes in export markets. US would be number one. Finland would be number two. Denmark would be number three. And maybe Canada number four. So we are also in the Canadian market for, I would say, for at least two generations. And my father always remembers the times of the early 80s or late 70s when he was you know, traveling the different cities and selling a lot of good wine here from the Dr. Pauli Burgweiler Wine Estate. So we start here with our dry Riesling, mm-hmm. really mineralic, really tropical Moselle Riesling, meaning mineralic, acidity, and, you know, the saltiness comes out a little bit too.
Yeah. This is your classic dry Moselle Riesling. And just a little bit of tropical and just some orange and going on. And you're right, the nice acidity at the back end. Just a very refreshing, clean wine. And we do. We see you guys. We're from Ontario at the LCBO. We see your wines represented all the time back in Southern Ontario.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well, let's... and by the way, any notes you would give on this wine that we're trying? That, I mean, that's my just armchair amateur way, but how would you describe this wine?
Okay, I mean, as a philosophy here in our wine estate, we of course, as you have seen, the vineyards are really steep. So we do everything by hand. So we also hand select the grapes. The philosophy of winemaking has been for the last 40 years to do everything in stainless steel and climate-controlled fermentation. So there's other wine estates who do this more a classical way. We made the step already before I took over the wine estate into more, I would say, modern winemaking in that time. Stainless steel, climate-controlled fermentation, meaning really clean, fresh wines. Mm-hmm. That's our philosophy. Other philosophy is that we want to keep the alcohol low. So it's not important for us to make Rieslings with really high alcohol. We always want to have them, you know, less than average.
What's this one here?
This one, I have to look it up. There it is. Okay. Okay. It's 11.5. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the advantage of our Rieslings here from the Moselle is the harmony of acidity and freshness and fruitiness, which this one shows. Yeah. And as I said, it's our classical estate Riesling, where we really make a few bottles of, and it's a good selling wine for us, and it's been popular really the last years. And
would this be the more? And sorry to interrupt. You're more, so this is your, I want to say entry line, but this is more your first level.
Yes, entry level, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, first, cheers, by the way. For
yeah, cheers. Prost, how we say in German.
Yes, okay. Prost. Okay, yes. No, the point I was going to say is that my favorite vineyards are the ones that, where the entry level wine, you can tell there's the quality and the time that went into it. Spire and Stellenbosch, Gugel, they're Cote de Rhone, you can tell. So, and that's what I appreciate about this fella here. What are you going to pour next? And then I'll ask a long question. And by the way, we have helpers here who can help pour the wine as well. So what?
Okay,
what are we moving on to next?
Okay. So next would be a single vineyard wine. Mm-hmm. The vineyard is called Uerziger Würzgarten. You hear we do everything in screw caps. So we are not using any corks anymore. Mm-hmm. So we stopped using corks like 20 years ago. This now is a single vineyard where we own 2 acres. Really old wines. Old wines meaning planted not by my father. My father is 83 now, planted by the generation before that. So we're talking the wines maybe between 80 and 100 years. Huh. Still. Original rootstock, so no cloning there, and really steep, really slopey, a lot of soil there. It's really special. The village is called Uerzig, Uerziger Würzgarten. Würzgarten translates to spice garden. So the soil there is different from basically all the other vineyards in the Moselle, because it has a lot of volcanic soil. Mm-hmm. Volcanic red soil with lots of minerals, which results in a Riesling that really shows the character of the terroir we have in this little spot.
Oh yeah, you could the nose is just, first way to put it, just fascinating.
Yes.
And there's a lot going on. And a little more spice on this one, so it's not just the fresh fruit.
Mm. Spicy, herbal.
Yes.
Almost have some, in my opinion, some green tea in the nose. And as I said, the minerals come out really great there, because you have to understand, we don't do any irrigation there. Mm-hmm. So the wines have to look for water. The root system goes down really deep. And as it rains, the rain picks up the minerality of the soil, goes down like 10, 15 feet, and it's really mineralic water. And then, of course, you have this mineralic rainwater concentrated in this bottle of Dr. Pauli Borgweiler Uerziger Würzgarten Dry Riesling.
So let's talk, by the way, just fantastic. A little bit more power on the mid-palate, nice linger on the finish. But again, still fresh, clean, and a lot going on. I want to hear about 2006. You said that's when you took over. You took over for your father here. What were those early days like for you?
Okay. For you to understand, my father took over in 1959.
Okay.
So he was, you know, many, many years taking care of the business. And he was growing the business really into other export markets. Okay. And I took over 2006. What was the question? The question was what the business was like.
No, there. No. What was it like for you? Because now you're taking over this huge historic estate. Were you nervous? Were you excited? How different are you as a winemaker now versus then? But I just want to start. I want to play Stefan in 2006. Okay. And how are you feeling?
Okay. So in 2006, I was something like 30 years old. Almost 30 years old, and I was, I finished my education in winemaking and wine marketing. And of course, back then I was already visiting the wine world and as well as selling wine in the world. So I was already traveling quite a bit. I did go to boarding school in Boston back when I was 16 years old. That was, I think, 93, to learn better English. And then, of course, I did my... I worked a few months at a wine importer in Texas. I worked a few months at a wine importer in California. I worked a few months at a wine importer in New York.
What was the Texas... if I can interrupt for a second. What was the... How different was the Texas wine importer place like versus other spots?
I have to say, okay, my father is totally in love with Texas.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
because he thinks it's different, okay?
It is.
And what is different is not bad, it's exciting, yeah. in that perspective. And as I can say, everything is much bigger in Texas.
Yes, it is.
So of course, the importer there or the distributor was in size maybe, I don't know, much, much more than anything you have here in Germany. I mean, just maybe 100 times bigger than the biggest guy here. I just remember that they got a delivery of Moët champagne, and it was, I think, 10 containers coming in, you know, in on one day, and they unloaded this in the warehouse, and that is for at least here in that time for a German importer. A big, big quantity.
Yeah.
So no, but I enjoyed it a lot. And it's, of course, it's interesting to travel the world and see how things are different in other countries. Not everything is good, not everything is bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's, of course, some advantages. And of course, Texas today is still one of our bigger markets because we have so many contacts there. And I cannot say anything.
I just find it fascinating. I did a road trip across the states. I spent time in Texas. Mm-hmm. And this is a stereotype. When I think Texas, I do not think low-alcohol German Riesling, even though I know it pairs so well with barbecue and the acidity with the sweetness and everything. It's just the joke that was going on in my head is it must be hard selling Riesling in Texas, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, I think the situation in Texas is they of course eat a lot of barbecue, but they also eat a lot of how I call this Tex-Mex cuisine,
uh-huh.
You know, with a lot of spices, yeah, and that of course really goes well with German Riesling or Mosel Riesling. Of course, the market share on Rieslings is not really high, but since I don't know how many people live in Texas, but I mean it's a big, big market. And then a little market share, and when you have a wine estate, a family run wine estate like we are, who focus a little bit on something, you can also sell some percentage of your production
right.
everywhere in
yeah.
the world. Yeah.
So what were you like as a winemaker when you took over? Like I ask this question a lot, but I'm always curious because I'll hear answers about how they've changed over the decades or mistakes they made early on. And I'm just always curious, were you in your early 30s, what were you as a winemaker like then versus now?
Okay. So, I mean, winemaking, of course, is always learning by experience and by trying something new. Yeah. And you cannot say that in 2006 when I took over, they did something wrong. They just did something what they were doing mm-hmm. for many years, And I just came in with you know, some more ideas of doing it a little bit different. Some people say better, but I mean, it all depends on of course, what you like or don't like. And of course, we today have the advantage. Or back in that time, I'm the winemaker, of course, but we also have two winemakers employed. Mm-hmm. So we have, we still had in that time the old winemaker from my father's side.
Okay.
And a new guy starting that was even younger than me. And he also got, you know, into more the dry riesling. So I mean, that was exactly the time when we also started. Back then, we maybe were selling 80% fruity. Now we maybe sell 80% dry. Okay. So that was a big transition. You were talking about that also German Rieslings, you know, back in the days were more more fruity. And today we do sell and we do produce a lot of dry Rieslings.
And by the way, what a great thing this to have that, as you said, transition, having an older winemaker part of the past with one that is more new. Mm-hmm. What is the, by the way, again, thank you mm-hmm. so for this that single vineyard dry Riesling. What is the next one on the list? By the way, it should also be said, thank you very much. Christy is the one who is displaying the wine and pouring it. Having it twist top makes it a lot easier than fumbling around with cork. So what is the third wine that we will be trying?
Okay. So we started with our basic dry Riesling, and we then, you know, taste our two premium dry Rieslings. Mm-hmm. So we tasted first the Oetzinger Würzgarten. Now we taste here our flagship vineyard in Bernkastel. Mm-hmm. The Bernkasteler, I know it's difficult to pronounce, Alte Badstube am Doktorberg.
Say that again.
Alte Badstube am Doktorberg.
Okay.
So that is our flagship vineyard. The wine estate is located here in Bernkastel. And this is for us our best vineyard. It's basically, it's like 5 minutes walking here from the wine estate. Really steep, really old wines, south facing, and always really ripe.
Yeah? It is just...
And I was showing, Ooh. And we were showing here 2018. So that's also interesting to taste some, also in the dry Riesling, some older vintages. I mean, I'm not saying older vintages.
But it's, like a, little, in the it's 40, a little time.
Some 2, 3, 4 yeah. 4 years old, you know, gives more aroma to the wine than the fresh ones.
Yeah. The first two wines we had were 2020, this one 2018. And yeah, it's not like it's crazy old, but 4 years, it's had a little time to develop. And you do get that, just that more honeyed, a little more, like just there's more depth on this one than the last two. Like this is a wine that immediately announces itself when you put your nose to the glass. And now you immediately are just trying to race through all these different adjectives and verbs to describe what the hell is going on with my nose, but I know I like it.
Yes, I would put it the yeah. same way.
Yeah. yeah, and a little bit of the honeyed, nutty note going on there as well. A little more ripe fruit than fresh. I mean, there's still freshness all over the place, but you can see a bit of a transition. What do you say to people? Like, we love... You know, obviously dry, off dry, sweet. These are incredibly well made wines. And, you know, as long as there's acidity, then they're beautiful. But what do you tell people out there listening that go, oh no, German Riesling, it's all going to be dry? What do you say to that?
It's all going to be dry or it's all going to be sweet?
Oh no, sorry, it's all going to be sweet. Excuse me. Excuse me.
Okay. Good. Okay. So I've done, you know, hundreds of consumer tastings in wine shops. In the U.S. especially. And of course, there's a perception that German wines are fruity. There's consumers who like this, yeah? And there's, of course, others who like dry Rieslings, yeah? It just depends on your personal...
personal taste.
Yeah, and personal taste, yes.
And what you're eating that day.
And what you're eating, exactly. And then, I mean, for sure, that is also the problem always with... I wouldn't say that the Mosel Rieslings that we make here are sweet. They are fruity. They have fruitiness. They have acidity. And as I said, they accompany well Tex-Mex cuisine. They accompany well Asian cuisine. they accompany well anything barbecue. So there's, I mean, there's hundreds of foods choices that work well with the fruity Riesling. And of course, big advantage on those, low alcohol. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you are in warmer climate, low alcohol is definitely a big advantage.
Yeah, it's funny. You go to places like California and some of the hotter weather, and then you have a 14.5%, 15% Chardonnay. And after one glass, you're like, I need water. I can need a break from this. How often does it happen where people come in and they say, I only like dry. I only want dry. And then they end up buying a case of something sweet.
That happens quite a lot, yeah. Especially if it goes with something like a Riesling Cabernet, which we will also taste later, because I think that's the classical Moselle Riesling with like 7-8 alcohol. But I mean, by numbers, quite sweet, but by taste, really mineralic, really fruity, and which definitely is something, you know, unique. And that's something, I mean, there's so many great wines in the world, but I think what we do here, we focus on something. First of all, we focus just on Riesling, on one grape varietal, and then we really focus on something unique that, you know, that we also export to Canada. I mean, there's a reason for this, because, you know, we have something special here. And so it's not another, I would say, another Chardonnay from somewhere in the world. It's something special, of course, which you you know, have to taste and have to understand. And I know German wines can be difficult to pronounce and difficult to understand, but I mean, I think you cannot do anything wrong with a Riesling Cabernet with low alcohol.
Yeah, it goes with so many different things, and yeah, that is one of the tough parts. That is one of the tough parts I find is trying to just explain to people what they're drinking and all the different classifications and things like that. What are we pouring next?
We are pouring next now how we call a fine herb Riesling that's half dry.
So fine. By the way, yes. For people when they see the word Feinberg and they see it on
fine herb, yes,
fine herb. When they see it on the label, what does that mean?
It just means half dry. But luckily, what we do have, we have on the back label, we have a how do you call this better?
We have
an explanation how dry and how fruity the wine is.
Oh, that's so perfect.
And we have this now. We are just tasting the German portfolio, but I mean, of course, in Canada we have this all in English. It then really shows you how dry or how fruity the wine is, to make it, you know, more simple for the consumer to understand how the wine is. Yeah,
that's such a smart idea, because the one thing when you start to study wine, you know, if you're trying to go and you go into Old World, it can be very difficult, especially, you know, if you go to France and Italy. And it's just the label and the geography, and you might not know. Wait, is that the region? Wait, oh, is that a village? Is that the name of the vineyard? I like what you have on the back, because you're getting rid of the shroud of mystery, and it's like, hey, you want the consumer to not only enjoy the wine, but if they know what they're drinking, I think that comfort level helps for people when they're consuming.
Definitely, and also for sweetness level. Also for understanding, when I took over in 2006, our fruity wines were sweeter than today. Mm-hmm. So we actually today, our winemaking philosophy is that we decreased the amount of residual sugar in the Riesling, in the Cabernet and in the Spätlese by, I would say, 20-30% compared to like 10 years ago, to make it more, I mean, not drier, but mm-hmm. less fruity, less sweet.
So what is it that we are drinking here?
Now we have a fine herb. Fine herb has a little bit more sweetness level. So mm-hmm. the dry Rieslings had around 8 gram sugar. Mm-hmm. This one has like 20 gram sugar, so almost double, or more than double.
Or the amount of sugar in a lot of dry, mass-produced California Pinot. I won't say their names, but there are some that have as much residual sugar, but they're dry. Anyway, sorry. That's just me getting angry at certain areas.
So that is, you know, as I said, 20 gram sweetness level. And of course, that is a wine we sell a lot in Germany. Not so much in export levels. In export, it's more the dry Rieslings or the fruity ones. Fine herb is kind of like in between. And that is more, it's a wine of a season. For example, to, now we have beginning of June, and we have here the, how we say, the asparagus season. It's yes. a typical local or German food. My wife always says we are crazy, or at least the older generation is like my mother seems to eat asparagus now every second day because it's season. But I mean, this is a fine herb Riesling that works well with this type of food. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been noticing at every restaurant, the menu sometimes, and it's, you know, it starts with asparagus and then it says the meat that's with it.
Right.
Yeah. And we're just like, hey, what's going on here? The transition to making more dry, was that just based on sort of global consumer habits?
I would say so, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that was also changing in much more so in other markets. I mean, I think today the US and Canada, we still sell quite a few cases of fruity Rieslings there. But when it comes to Scandinavia, it's mostly dry. Mm-hmm. And those markets in Scandinavia were also really fruity back 30, 40 years ago.
I don't know why people just shouldn't embrace more, even just the semi-dry. Because just there's such a powerful finish on that wine. And it's just I find, you know, it just lingers with you. And again, the acidity is there. There's nothing about this that says I'm drinking this gloppy sweet wine. And I think it's one of the main things I want to tell people is that these wines have so much have more versatility than you would think.
Exactly.
And, yeah. No, it's fantastic.
We as a wine estate, we try to really make the wine more consumer friendly. Mm-hmm. As I said, we have this tasting sweetness scale on the back label. But also, if we have a dry Riesling, we actually put the name dry Riesling on the front label. Mm-hmm. So it's better to understand because, I mean, I understand that, those German labels can be hard and really difficult to understand.
Long names.
Too much information.
Well, it's also
too precise.
Yeah. for dummy North Americans like me, I remember when I was studying and doing the diploma, and always the German regions. I was just like, "Is there how many syllables? Is it a 12-syllable word?"
Exactly.
And then I would get uncomfortable. By the way, a shout out again to Christy, who is doing all the pouring. She feels a little nervous when she's pouring in our glasses. She doesn't want to pour too much or spill. I'm curious a little bit about your father. Just some of your memories when you were younger and. Let's start there because I don't want to ask two questions in one. How would you describe what your father was like as a winemaker?
Of course, he was focusing more on the traditional way of winemaking in his first years. I said he took over 59. 59, of course, was a different time than it is today.
Yes.
And so we continued, I think, the first few years when he took over the wine estate from his parents, the really traditional way, but then decided after his trips to California and Texas that and after seeing the Napa Valley and everything booming there, that he really has to change something here, that we have to get more efficient to survive, to put
really?
It this way, because we were still making wines like, you know, generations before in our old wine cellars, which are really, you know, generations old, really nice to look at, but of course hard to work in. So he came back and then decided in the early 80s to build a modern winemaking facility outside of the old village and outside of the old buildings.
Okay, so I have a follow-up, but first, I just wonder if you could tell people what we are drinking now.
Okay, now we are drinking our, how I say, that is the classical Mosel Riesling, a Cabernet, a Riesling Cabernet, low alcohol. As I said already before, low alcohol, high minerality, and that is for me a really go-to wine for Asian cuisine and Tex-Mex.
Oh yeah,
And that is a wine where we always get also good ratings in
soft.
The international press.
Just soft, fruity loveliness. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. This is like if I'm going to do my palate stereotype of Moselle Cabernet, this would be it. Yeah, that's lovely.
And that is for me kind of like a Sunday lunch wine. Mm-hmm. You understand what I mean with this? I mean it's a
early lunch.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt you with the alcohol, and it has some freshness.
Okay, I'm gonna say this right now. This is a wine hot take. The brunch community needs to say get rid of a little bit of mimosa and put in a little bit of Moselle. From mimosa to Moselle, this is just as good as any bad orange juice crappy Prosecco combination. I would take this any day over that.
Yes.
One thing that just struck me. I'm talking about how your father went to Napa and visited these places and saw just the efficiency that was going on.
Right.
I always believe in the idea that, and we see it all the time in New World, where New World gets influenced by the Old World. Mm. Go to any Pinot Noir producer in Ontario or California, and they will always say the same line. We make ours in the Burgundian style.
Right.
Everyone does in the Burgundian style. But I'm curious, how much did, and you kind of talked about it, how much did the Old World take from Mondavi or California about how they could change the way that they're making wine? How much influence did California have on Germany?
No, I think it really had a lot of influence on my father, because he saw, okay, if I'm not getting here more efficient in this little Moselle Valley here, the others are with a lot of money and a lot of knowledge, of course, investing in great winemaking there. And I think we did the right step to move out here out of the old cellars. That was the big disadvantage. I mean, logistics is here a problem, because it's a touristic little town, Berncastle.
Oh, yeah.
But there's no way to really park a truck or a car in front of the house.
No,
it's everything small here.
Okay? Yeah,
it's different from Napa Valley here for sure. So, but I mean, we, as I said, we built how I call this a Napa Valley winery on the fields where you have place where you can park and where you just have enough place to work with the machines you need to. Because especially in these days here, like everywhere worldwide, but after Corona, it got more and more difficult finding good workers here, and especially in the countryside in Germany. I mean, you always have to remember we are here in a country where minimum wages are pretty high compared to the other wine world, and of course we are on the countryside. And people that work or that live here better or get more money if they work in the banking industry in Luxembourg, for instance.
Of course. Okay, I've got some follow-ups there. But what is the next wine that we'll
pour? We have now another cabinet, 2017.
Oh, okay.
A little older. Here again from our flagship, when you have the Dr. Berg.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be. I can't wait to. It's aged Riesling is just so. It's just such a unique drinking experience. So you mentioned just about the higher wages, and also especially after coronavirus, how much tougher it was or just to keep and retain workers. How much harder is that in regions like this, where to be someone that is working in the fields requires so much more work and ability just because how steep everything is? It's a lot harder to pick a grape here than it is, say, even in Bordeaux, where it's not as dramatic the incline.
That's correct. The first problem we have here is that in Germany you better find local people that grew up in the region and that, you know, that have some background to the region. If you get somebody from France working here, they will definitely enjoy this for a few months. But when the winter time comes, you know, the winter is the winter. You understand what I mean?
Oh, yeah. We're from Ontario.
You're from Ontario.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's of course, it's a quiet season here. So that's why, I mean, right now we have a really good team of young people here who really grew up in the Mosel. But again, there's a lot of wine estates looking for people, same as restaurants here are looking for people. Because again, it's a seasonal work. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's also in the vineyards or in the restaurants, of course. And then you have a few months where you don't have work, and that's a problem. And then of course the unemployment rate seems to be really low here, so that's why we have some seasonal workers from Poland coming for picking. Mm-hmm. But that's the case for the last 25 years. With all the wine estates here to get some help when we pick the grapes. It's difficult finding people, but of course if you offer some benefits and you find some local people working the steep hills in the Mosel Valley.
Oh, it is I don't say how dangerous, but how many other areas in the world are harder to pick grapes than here?
I think there's vineyards there's some steep vineyards in Switzerland for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some steep vineyards in Italy.
Yeah,
there's some steep vineyards everywhere in the world. I would say also somewhere in Argentina for sure.
Yeah,
but I mean, of course, as you said, I mean, if you drive around here 5 miles on the right side or 5 miles to the left side, you think, oh my God, who's picking all those vineyards? Because there's so many, yeah?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not so dangerous like you think. You get used to everything. You just have to be careful. And I think you find people doing this, yeah.
I'm going to grab your mic because you're opening. You've got some super old wines. And also because I'm going to take a guess that Christy, who's doing a great job pouring, she is going to be scared to death to try to open these wines. So I'm going to just we'll just pause for a quick second. And we're back. And Stefan's been nice enough to have opened up some of your older Rieslings. And my first thought, just looking at this, is I expected the color to be even darker. Because in 1981, this is 41 years old, if I do my math correctly. I was expecting even a darker hue on this wine.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, it's already golden in color.
It is.
But it's still a Riesling, yeah? And it was kept in good condition. That's always important. So it comes from our private wine cellar here. Mm-hmm. It also was recorked 20 years ago. It really shows the potential. So, and this is like this is not an ultra-premium Riesling from that time. It's a Spätlese. Mm-hmm. It's a late harvest Riesling from 81. And I think it really shows the potential we have here, that you cannot only age Burgundy and Bordeaux wines, you can also age good quality Rieslings from the Mosel, as you said, 41 years and still drinking fresh.
I think if I was doing this blind, and someone said, "How old is this?" I think I would go no more than like 20 years. There still is plenty of there's still plenty of lemon and lime. There's still the fruit is still there, and I mean that's yes, you're getting, you know, the nuttiness, a little marzipan or whatever, but there still is fruit in this glass. Kudos to kudos to you guys for doing this. This is great. First off, I think it is one of the coolest things. There's just something interesting about trying wines that's really old, because you'll picture yourself back in that moment. You know, I was like, okay, what was going on in 1981? And it's like, wait, Michael Jackson wasn't even a thing. And, well, right. The Rolling Stones are, you know, still have 40 more years left in them. Yeah. But, like, whenever I try an old wine, I try to think, what was 1981? That was Joe Montana winning the Super Bowl or Wayne Gretzky. Just, and again, I'm using North American references. But that's, what to me, always one of the coolest things about trying old wine is what was going on then.
Exactly. No, and it really shows me that, I mean, we are making wine here in the family for many, many generations, going back 12 generations, and it shows me that, of course, also the generations before did some great, outstanding Rieslings.
All right, I'm going to ask you a very deep psychological question, and I just thought of this now. When you try a wine like this, how often do you think about your own family and think about, you know, what your dad and mom were doing back 40 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. That's how you just said you're thinking about some mm-hmm. some sports stars or some music stars,
poppers. E.T.
Exactly, back in the days. No, I'm thinking, of course, 81. I was like a little boy running around here. Still, I think I don't remember too much from the year. But I mean, of course, it's still amazing for me to see how good it is to have Rieslings that can age so well.
And by the way, there's still freshness. That's I think people get worried. Oh, it's going to be an old wine. It's going to be musty and blah 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 blah. But there's still a freshness here.
Acidity. I mean, remains in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you always want to go into wine? Was there a moment where you were looking and thinking, maybe I want to do something else? It seems like a lot of work, and I don't want to be on those steep slopes in February trying to make ice wine.
Exactly. No, we don't do ice wine in February. We do it in December. But okay. I first made my studies in tropical as a German in the car industry.
Okay.
So I went south to Bavaria. To make my studies there in car marketing or car engineering in that perspective, but then I figured out that is also a lot of work so in the car industry, so I better do what I've also done as a kid already, because growing up in a family run wine estate means that even with the age of, I don't know, like 10, I was already, sitting on the table with some customers from the US, from Canada, from even in that time, in the 80s, Japan was like the number one market for German Rieslings. Oh. So I think I was, fortunate to meet a lot of international guys or international cultures when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And also, I think I made my first trips to the US, in the wine shops when I was 17, 18, and 19.
And you couldn't drink.
I couldn't even drink.
You couldn't even drink there.
I couldn't even drink. Or in that perspective, sometimes I was, I think before I was 21, already selling wine in the US, but nobody knew. No, but I mean, for sure, I had some big experience already when I was a teenager, in drinking wine and also, in the international sales of wine.
What is the next old one, Christy?
Next one.
You did a great job, by the way, pouring.
It's a 1979 Auslese.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
Here from the neighboring village of Bernkastel called Kracker Himmelreich.
Mm-hmm.
That's.
And for people that are listening, if you as the wine is being poured,
yes,
just the quick difference for people between the Cabernet, Spätlese, and Auslese, for people listening that are listening to this to learn a little bit more about German
wine.
Yes.
Okay. So there is, in general, saying there's three different classifications on Moselle Rieslings, on the fruity style. So you could go, to make it more easy to understand, to the Olympic Games. So I would say the Cabernet is like the bronze medal, the Spätlese is like the silver medal, and the Auslese, which we're tasting now, is like the gold medal. So that means basically when you pick the grapes, the gold medal are the the best grapes, yeah, the ripest grapes. The Spätlese are in the middle, and the bronze medal are the Cabernet grapes. But again, a bronze medal doesn't mean it's a bad wine.
No.
It's like in the Olympics, if you have a bronze medal, you're also one of the top stars in the sports. Yeah. It's the same here. I think when you have a Cabernet from a single vineyard here from the Dr. Pauli Brockweiler Wine Estate, you still have a really great wine.
Oh, God, yeah, 100%. So on this fella, I mean, there's a lot, again, a lot going on the nose, Stefan. And I'm going to let you take over on the aromatic profile of this fella.
Yes, and of course you said the one before was not so...
And this one is, much darker, much darker, more golden.
Much more golden. Of course, this is, as an Auslese, was a much riper wine than the one before. It's 79 vintage, I would say. What is it, 42 years old?
This is 43 years old.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You're better at mathematics than I am.
So, I'll take the mathematics. I will fail at the pronunciations.
Okay, good. Yeah. But I mean, it has, of course, I think it has a lot of honey.
Mm-hmm.
And also, again, some pineapple, honey, peach flavor.
Yeah.
I would just describe this.
And again, congrats on the fact that you can easily... You don't have to search for the fruit, you know, because sometimes you'll try really old wine and you know you want to like it. I want to like it. And you know in your back of your mind, oh, this is gone. Because you're searching and searching for the fruit, you know, like trying to find your wallet. This one, it's the opposite. Like the fruit is right there.
Yes, it's really fruity. And it's not, how you would say, it's not sweet. Yeah, mm-hmm. For what it is. Yeah? It's, I would even consider this as being... On a drier side, yeah, for now, for drinking, yeah.
Yeah. And again, good for you guys for still keeping, just having this library of wines available.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, I mean, to taste some old vintage stuff, as you said. Looking back in the days, what people were doing in the 70s, 60s, 80s, whatever.
And just so different.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just so different. What's this, by the way, what is this town like? Like, we're in Bernkastel now, right before the start of tourism season, which is kind of by design. But how crazy, how busy does it get here?
Yeah, it can get busy, especially on the weekends. You know, that's of course the hot spot here. But what changed here in tourism was that we have a lot of... what we call this, cruise ships, hotel ships.
Yes, yeah, we see them all over.
Where you also have a lot of Canadians and Americans and South Africans on there doing a trip here in the Mosel, which is really convenient and easy because you have your hotel always with you, and they do a trip of a few days here, basically cruising the rivers here in Germany and also stopping in Bernkastel. So that brings us more Canadian tourists here. But of course, tourism here is also really international. So we have a lot of Danish, Dutch, Belgium. But again, it's maybe close. It's maybe 3 hours drive to Brussels, but it's a longer drive to bigger German cities. So that makes sense. So it's basically the surrounding... you know, area that comes here visiting. But then, of course, we also have a lot of Scandinavians that do here, vacation for a week or so.
And how much, you're saying that you focus a lot on the export. How much of your wines is drunk locally versus
you mean
drunk?
Sold locally.
Okay.
Sold in the Vinotheque. Again, in the Vinotheque, I would say 90% is export.
Mm-hmm.
So all the people who come here are not Germans.
Yeah.
They are people from other countries, so I count that in, yeah?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So it's really international here. I would say our Vinotheque team speaks almost no German.
Really?
Okay.
So why is... I was curious about this because we were visiting another winery and they were saying that, you know, we were visiting Marcus Molitor and they were saying that, you know, 99% of Germans just drink more 2 euro supermarket wine and a lot of the nice stuff doesn't get drank. And I'm curious about that.
That is also my thinking, yes.
Yeah.
Because I was, as I said, my study started in the car industry. And the car industry in Germany did a perfect job in marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if you have some money in Germany, it's really important for you to have the newest German car, BMW,
right.
whatever.
Okay.
Every 2 or 3 years, and it's important that you have one that has, you know, 5 horsepower more than your neighbor.
Right.
And if you spend all the money on those really expensive cars, because they are so expensive and they got so more expensive the last few years, you don't have money for anything else. So if you compare this, it's really a tragedy. If I even compare this with, because my wife was born and raised in the Ukraine, and I think the food there is much better than here in Germany, and also the supermarkets have a much better offering than we have here, because here it's all about the price. So if you go in a big city in Ukraine in a supermarket, you have an international portfolio of different stuff. Here you just have the cheapest.
Right.
You know, that's the important thing. So as you said, I mean, there's a lot of consumers who, even if they have money, they would go to the supermarket. And let's say in Ukraine or in Canada or in the US, you would say, okay, I got this bottle. It's a great bottle. You know, it costs, let's say, $20. And it comes from this specific region. And so on. It's a great wine. And here it's more like, you know, I bought this wine. You know, it's from Bordeaux, but it's $2.99. You know, that's important.
Right.
You know, and it still has the name Bordeaux on it. Or I bought this champagne, and it's $6.99.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still champagne.
Yeah.
And it's for the wealthy people who drive Porsche and BMW.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
By the way, if you're getting a champagne for €6, you got a counterfeit champagne. Okay. So we noticed this driving around. It's like everyone has got a really gorgeous car, and I'm going to drive my car for 15 years, but I'm going to buy, you know, I'm going to buy good wine. Okay, that makes so much sense. What is the last wine? And again, Stefan, thank you so much. Like, this has been just a wonderful tasting, just a really nice range. And I think one of the messages for the audience out there is that try different German Rieslings, because you have so much different flavor profile that can go with so many different things.
Okay, yes, we will end the degustation with our, you know, ultra premium wine, how we say, Trockenbärenauslese.
Yep. Oh,
so
yes.
So it's an extremely, sweet dessert wine. Vintage 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Comes here again from our flagship vineyard. And that's, of course, something really unique, because when you pick it, it's called Trockenbärenauslese. So you basically pick the raisins out of the bunch of grapes, and then you have, like, in one bunch of grapes you maybe have 2-3 raisins. So it's a lot of work. You have to hand select thousands of botrytis affected raisins to make half bottle like this.
And for people that wonder, why is this so expensive, the amount of human work, and I don't know why I use the word human, but just the amount of work that goes into this, and the amount of time, and in the cold, and also dangerous, and finding just the right grapes. I mean, there's a lot of work that's going into this little glass of 17-year-old wine that we are drinking.
Yes, especially because it's a Trockenbärenauslese, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of work, a lot of hand-picking, a lot of hand-selecting to find the right grapes for this wine.
At any point, sir, people, I've read this before, are people attached to cords or rope or anything, like going down some of those vineyards that are so steep?
No, not really, no. You're just getting used to it. I mean, there's people also living somewhere in the mountains in Canada, and, you know, and living there without ropes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, it's, you're just getting used to everything, yeah? And it's not so, because the advantage is, since you are, the soil is rather soft, so it's not so hard. It's not like a solid rock. It's a soft rock.
Right.
So that gives you, like, steps, yeah? So you're not falling down, or, you know, it's not that slippery than on a solid rock.
Last question for you. Just, I was curious, what... is there anything, any changes or what do you foresee for the future for you guys in the next, let's say, 5-10 years? Or is it just keep as she goes and keep the quality as high as possible?
No, I mean, I think we had a lot of changes already the last 2-3 years.
Of course.
I mean, with all the supply chain and the logistic problematics we had. It's difficult now for me to predict what's happening the next time. Right. Everything can happen. Yeah. If you consider that there's a war going on, like 20 hours driving from here, and that, of course, we have some problems here in Germany getting, or maybe soon getting enough energy for heating or for producing glass bottles. That's, of course, all political. And in my opinion, that was, you know, a problem here of the German politics. Too much focus on a supply of one country. But I mean, in wine production, of course, I think who knows what's going to happen in Asia, in the market there.
Of course.
I mean, we had some, I mean, the Asian markets had been demanding also here Moser Rieslings a lot the last 10 years. We don't know what's going to happen there political. But that's all, on the selling perspective. On the production perspective, I think an issue will be to find good people for working here. We are lucky that we now have a really good team. Of course, quality-wise, of course, we have climate change. That is also what we see here, which is not a really big disadvantage for us because, we are like Canada. We are up north. So if it gets a little bit warmer in the summer, it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
If it gets a little bit warmer in the winter, it also doesn't hurt that much. I mean, for the grapes or so. Of course, it might change a lot for the people way south from us, where it's too warm. But I think for Moser Rieslings, we will manage this, the climate change, and I think things look good.
It's funny, just, you have to, there's so many things you can't control. The weather, spending habits of certain parts of the world. The only thing you can really control is the quality of your wines.
Exactly.
And you've certainly done it from 2020 to 1979. Stéphane Pavy, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it, and I can't impress upon enough to people listening to come and visit this area and just try these range of wines. They're beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.